for me to do a lesson on the lesson that he didn't get the time to cover. So that's what we're doing. This is not, I think Jim messed up. I'm going to have fun doing this lesson, so I think that that's good. I find it fun to try to figure out what the sermons in the book of Acts are about. And for some reason, that's harder than I thought it would be. In Acts chapter 2, if you look at the sermon that Peter is preaching and that they're all repeating to the people there, it resulted in a conversion. So much of the message, I think, is that Jesus is not dead. In fact, Jesus was raised, and this is what God was talking about. And here are passages about resurrection and not dying, or rather dying and coming back after the dead, I should say. And the people who talked about it are dead, but Jesus did not see corruption. And that's what the sermon is about. Jesus is not rotting. He's gone. He's up, and he's raised, and we saw it. So that's what that sermon is about. The sermon that Stephen preaches in Acts chapter 7 covers Old Testament history, but it doesn't cover the whole Old Testament. It covers very specific parts, and I wondered at one point, well, why these stories and not the other stories? And so that's what we're going to look at, this whole sermon that Stephen preached. And it's going to grow out of the consternation that shows up at the end of chapter 6. I'm just going to read this here, starting in verse 8. And Stephen, full of grace and power, was doing great wonders and signs among the people. When some of those who belonged to the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called, and of the Cyrenians and the Alexandrians and of those of Cilicia and Asia rose up and disputed with Stephen, but they could not withstand the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. Then they secretly instigated men who said, and I think that the charges they're going to bring up against Stephen kind of fit with what he's going to talk about. We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council, and they set up false witnesses who said, "This man never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law, for we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and will change the customs that Moses delivered to us." And gazing at him, all who sat in the council saw that his face was like the face of an angel. I would love to know what that means. Does that mean that he had a baby face? Does that mean that he was glowing from within? Does that mean angel means messenger? He looked like he had a message. I don't know what that means. I think that's a fun thing to wonder about. He's speaking blasphemous words against Moses and God, and I really think that that is one of the major themes that his sermon is going to talk about. He's also speaking blasphemy about like everything, apparently. They say that he never stops talking about that, which, you know, that's not even physically possible, but they're just throwing them all under the bus, and they're saying all these terrible things about him. But the reality is, can you find any truth to their lies? Now, Matt very rightly said this morning that Satan does not have any truth in anything he says. And that's absolutely 100% true. I'm not even modifying that. What we do know is that Satan takes truths or takes things and he corrupts them and he bends them and he changes them. And so when we use the phrase, there was a little bit of truth in that lie, that does not mean that there was any truth in what he said. When the truth is corrupted, guess what? It's not anymore. It's not the truth. And so when I use the phrase, Satan, there was a little bit of truth in what they're saying, well, that's not true. But we're going to move on. We're not going to get into truth and not truth. They took the ideas. In fact, Jesus himself said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. And when they were charging against Jesus, they would use those words, and they didn't even get it right. And so they're bringing up all these old charges. Is there a change between the old covenant and the new covenant? Well, there absolutely is. Is he blaspheming Moses and God? I don't think so at all. I think the rest of the sermon is going to uphold Moses and uphold God. And the big question is, who's actually blaspheming Moses and who's actually blaspheming God? By the end of the sermon, I think it is the people who are against Stephen who do that. All right, so we're going to just work our way through his lesson, and hopefully, it's a long chapter. Hopefully, we won't go on for too long. So chapter 7, verse 1, and the high priest said, "Are these things so?" And Stephen said, "Brothers and fathers, hear me. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Go out from your land and from your kindred, and go into the land that I will show you.' And then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran. And after his father died, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. And yet he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot's length, but promised to give it to him as a possession and to his offspring after him, though he had no child. And God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others who would enslave them and afflict them for 400 years. And I will judge that nation that they serve, said God. And after that, they shall come out and worship me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. And the sermon keeps continuing on, but we're just going to stop and look here at Abraham. There are some points and there are some key ideas. And the points, the effort with the key ideas is I'm trying to have, these are some of the things that I think carry through the whole sermon, even if they're not necessarily repeated, but some of them get repeated. So there's interesting ideas. Go out from your land, go out from what you know, go out from your kindred. That isn't necessarily repeated a lot, but this is God giving instruction and giving direction. There are promises, and usually we think of promises as the good things, but then again, he's also telling them that they're going to be enslaved and that nation is going to be judged. So that's, I mean, I don't know if that's a promise. God's telling what's going to happen. So in some senses, that's a promise, and we're going to see how that is fulfilled. But God is revealing the things that are not yet. You're going to get the land, but you don't have the land. Your offspring are going to have, you don't even have any offspring. And so he's talking about these things that are coming down. And then there is this covenant that is given, and it's given to Abraham. And Abraham passes it on, and Isaac passes it along, and Jacob passes it on. And I think that those are some key ideas, that God is giving them these commands towards things that they do not know or do not have or do not understand very well. There's promises. Things are coming down the road, coming down the pipeline, and God is establishing a covenant. He's establishing this connection, and they needed to keep passing it on to their kids and keep that ball rolling. And now, I'm including Joseph and baby Moses on one slide. This is the only way I was going to keep this on one sheet of paper for the handout, which, I don't know if you know me, I never want to staple handouts together. So we're cramming a lot into these slides, and you're just going to have to hang on. So let's read 9 through 16 first. And the patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt. God was with him, and rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, whom made him ruler over Egypt and over all his household. Now there came a famine throughout all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers on their first visit. And on the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and summoned Jacob his father and all his kindred, 75 persons in all. And Jacob went down into Egypt, and he died, he and our fathers. And they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham had bought for the sum of silver from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. So we have some points and then some key ideas here in this telling of Joseph. There's a lot of things that we can mention. We talked about the 75 persons. I don't know if every detail is vital for the overall message. But what we have here is one, Joseph, who was with the jealous brothers. He was made low and he was sold away, but then he was made a ruler. And we see that God shows up and clearly does that later on with Moses. But here, in verse 9, he was sold him into Egypt, but God was with him and rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him Pharaoh, who then made him ruler over Egypt. We might even say that God made him ruler over Egypt. It's kind of curious in the grammar there. So here is one who was lowly, who was cast out from the brethren, but God rescued him and lifted him up. And the phrase raised up is not there, I don't think, but the raised up one is the phrase that I have in my mind throughout this whole sermon. God raised him up and then had him ready. And we see that when there was the famine, when there was the need, and we know this story, when the need came on all the brothers, God had raised up one of their own who was their savior, who's going to defend them and keep them full and keep them healthy. And they became known to the Egyptians, and they all moved down, and things are good. But then there's the mention of getting buried back in Shechem. There's this connection through the whole sermon about the land. When he's talking about Abraham, here is the way Stephen talks about it. Here, where we are now, this was what was going to be given to Abraham. He didn't get it. They keep trying to get back there, and they're burying those who pass away. And so we see this one who is raised up, taken out from the brothers, and raised up above, not just the brothers, but the whole of the Egyptians. And now continuing in verse 17 with baby Moses. But as the time of the promise drew near, which God granted to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose over Egypt another king who did not know Joseph. He dealt shrewdly with our race and forced our fathers to expose their infants so that they would not be kept alive. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight. And he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. So we have similar points that are connected here with baby Moses. He was, I love how it says, and when he was exposed so carefully, wrapped up, and in a, you know, he was exposed into a river in a basket that would float him so he wouldn't drown. I love the play with words there. Oh yeah, Pharaoh, we did what you told us to. We threw him in the river carefully in a basket 3 months late. And I just think that that's such a funny way of expressing it. But this is all about, according to Stephen, the time of the promise drawing near. And the people are getting numerous. So God is working for his people and he's blessing them. But there's this troubler who deals shrewdly. I looked up that word because I thought that was interesting. Craftily, outwitting, overreaching. Here's this one who is causing trouble on God's people. And now we have the fulfillment of the promise of the enslavement. Not that everyone was excited about that, but this is what's going to happen, God tells Abraham. And the things are beginning to take place. And so another theme in this lesson is God says it's going to happen, and it does happen. And so we have baby Moses. Baby Moses who, he's not really raised up much yet. He's a baby, and he's being raised, but he's being raised, verse 22, in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, mighty in words and deeds. We don't get a lot of detail about just how well-educated Moses was, but he would have been raised as a prince of Egypt to be one of the princes and rulers of Egypt, and that is who is now going to be there for the slaves of Egypt. So in a lot of ways, he is raised up as well. And now we're going to continue in verse 23, trying to keep moving along. We have, I didn't know what to call Moses, young Moses and adult Moses. You guys can argue about my titles here for Moses. But starting in verse 23, and when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. And on the following day, he appeared to them as they were quarreling and tried to reconcile them, saying, men, you're brothers, why do you wrong each other? But the man who was wronging his neighbor thrust him aside, saying, who made you a ruler and judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed that Egyptian yesterday? At this retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. And so he is visiting his brothers, just even that phrase. Who does this start reminding you of, right? He's visiting his brothers, and he's defending and avenging his people. He strikes down this Egyptian. He supposed, I just love verse 25. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. I don't think that's hubris. It could have been. He could have been, oh, God made me awesome, and everyone's going to recognize just how awesome I am. But we don't have to assume that that's the way he was. In fact, Moses is the meekest man. We find that in the law. He thought they'd recognize. I've been raised in the household. I'm literally set above all of them, and I can defend them, and I can speak for them, and I can protect them. They're going to recognize this. And they did not recognize him at all. In fact, he thrust him aside. Who are you to judge me? Does this remind you of anybody, right? God's raised up one defends the oppressed and avenges the enemy. God's raised up one supposed that God's people would understand. God's raised up one was rejected. I think we start to see what the point of this sermon is. I think it's pretty compelling. Then we get adult Moses. Starting in verse 32. 32. No, starting in verse 30. Sorry. Now when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in a flame of fire and a bush. When Moses saw it, he was amazed at the sight. And as he drew near to look, there came the voice of the Lord. I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and Jacob. And Moses trembled and did not dare look. Then the Lord said to him, take off the sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their groaning, and I have come down to deliver them, and now come, I will send you to Egypt. So now we have Moses, this one who has been raised up, separated, trying to be a deliverer for his brothers. He is there in the presence of God. You know, I've heard of a preacher who said, you know, you need to take off your feet because this is holy ground. He's there in the presence of God, trying to be reverent, hearing the very words of God, God who sees, God who hears, God who came down, I guess, into the bush, or came down with access to the people. And God says, I will send you. And here's this man, raised up with God, raised up to be sent by God to save the needy people. Who does this remind you? And then look at the way that Stephen starts preaching in verse 35. We're going to read 35 through 38. He says this, Moses. And that's, I'd never noticed this until I was working on this lesson. Look at the word this. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge? This man God sent as both ruler and redeemer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in Egypt and at the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our fathers. He received living oracles to give to us. This, I think, is the whole point of the lesson. This Moses, whom the people rejected, this is the one that God sent. This is the man that led them out. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, there's going to be another one like me. This is the one who spoke to God all the time, in particular, at Mount Sinai. And then you go back and look at all the things about this man. This is the Moses they rejected. God sent this man as ruler and redeemer. This man led them out doing what? Waving a sword, performing wonders and signs. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, there's going to be another prophet like me. He's the prototype, right? This is the one who spoke with God, received living oracles from God, and was told to give those living oracles to the people. This is Jesus. That's who this sermon is about. This Moses, this man, this is the one rejected, sent out as ruler and redeemer, wonders and signs. Moses was the anti-type of the one that was coming. He spoke with God, got the word of God, and was given the job to give that word out. I mean, is he talking about Moses or is he talking about Jesus in these verses? I just think that that's so strong right here. And I'm wondering how his audience, if they can catch it. Because how many times have I read it and not caught it? Well, we're going to continue now with verse 39. I think this is the central. This is the fulcrum. This is what it's about. And now here's the conclusion. I'm going to read 39 all the way through 50, actually. Our fathers refused to obey him, but thrust him aside, and in their hearts they returned to Egypt, saying to Aaron, make for us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses who led us out from the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him. And they made a calf in those days, and offered a sacrifice to the idol, and were rejoicing in the work of their hands. But God turned away and gave them over to worship the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets. Did you bring to me slain beasts and sacrifices during the 40 years in the wilderness in the house of Israel? You took up the tent of Moloch and the star god of Raphan, the images that you made to worship, and I will send you into the exile beyond Babylon. Now that's actually from Amos, where we've been studying. And as I was working on this lesson, I was recognizing it feels like all my sermons are somehow connected with my Bible classes lately, and I haven't meant for it. But this is a sermon about failing people written to a bunch of people who were also failures. And we need to learn from that. We need to not fail. And so the Bible class was pretty depressing, and it turns out that the sermon is pretty depressing. I don't mean to just throw depressing messages on you all day long, but I found that that was pretty interesting. There's a bit of a change, though, in verse 44. Our fathers had the tent of witness in the wilderness, just as he who spoke to Moses directed him to make it, according to the pattern that he had seen. Our fathers, in turn, brought it in with Joshua, and they dispossessed the nations that God drove out before our fathers. And so it was until the days of David, who found favor in the sight of God and asked to find a dwelling place for the God of Jacob. But it was Solomon who built a house for him. Yet the Most High does not dwell in houses made by hands. As the prophet says, "Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What kind of house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Did not my hand make all these things?" I think it's kind of interesting. 44 through 50 isn't quite as ugly or harsh of a set of instructions. He's pointing out their failure. Our fathers refused. Our fathers did not obey. Our fathers thrust them aside. They said, "Make for us gods." And they made a god, and they rejoiced in the things of their own hands. They rejoiced in their own handiwork. And they said, "As for this Moses, we don't even know where he is." I wonder if that's the way a lot of people might even consider Jesus at that time. Where is this Jesus? You say he's come back from the dead. I don't know. I mean, you saw him with your own eyeballs, but yeah, I don't know. They're rejoicing in their own handiwork. And that's what the fathers were doing. And I think that they need to take the lesson for themselves. But then we get, okay, we talked about that. And then God let them. He's like, "All right, if you're going to reject and you're going to go off," and then we have that quotation for Amos where God turned away and gave them over to that. But starting in 44, but they also made the tent, right, the tabernacle, and they made it the right way, and they made it with Moses' work, and they brought it into the land with Joshua. They must not be totally bad, and David was okay with them, but it was Solomon who built the temple. But even in that set of verses where it seems like they're doing a good thing, the conclusion that Stephen is drawing out here is, but you can't contain God. And I wonder if that's really the point. They were rejecting God, and maybe they were, "Well, we've got a tent where we can have him, or we've got an Ark of the Covenant that he can sit on, or we can build up a nice temple, and we can have God, and we can control God, and we can have God for our own." I'm wondering if that's the idea there. But you can't hold God. Especially if you reject God, you can't just drag him along in some tent supplies. So what is it he's preaching to an audience? What did this audience inherit? What is their background? Well, their background is a series of people who rejected the one that God raised up, that turned to the things that they made themselves, and I'm going to make the argument, though they had the tent, it seems like they were trying to just own God for themselves and make him their own little pet god or like an idol. I think that that might be what those verses about the tent and the temple are about. These are people whose fathers rejected God, rejected the raised up one of God. These are people whose fathers loved what they made in their own hands and thought that they could hold God on their own. And that's kind of what Jesus dealt with. It seems like that's what Stephen's dealing with too. And he turns right around and says, "You." Our fathers, our fathers, our fathers. And now he says, "You," and this is where the sermon gets, you know, all spitball-y and vinegar. "You stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, whom you have now betrayed and murdered. You who received the law as delivered by angels and did not keep it. You just like your fathers." Just like your fathers. Jesus said practically the same thing. "Woe to you because you built up the tombs of the prophets when your fathers killed the prophets. And by honoring the tombs of the prophets that your fathers killed, it's more like you're honoring the fact that your fathers killed them." I think that that's a really harsh and interesting argument. You're just repeating the same thing as what Jesus said. It's exactly what Stephen is saying. Your fathers killed everyone who was talking about the righteous one to come, and then you killed the righteous one who came. You betrayed and murdered that righteous one. The end of 52 is really strong. "You received the law delivered by angels. You received the law and didn't keep it." And in this sermon, not my sermon, in this sermon, I think receiving the law and keeping the law is holding on to Jesus. I think that that's really the point here. You received the law, and then you murdered it. They're no different from their fathers. No different from their fathers. And every generation tries to be, oh, I want to be different from my dad. At least from ages like 1 to 5, you want to be exactly like your dad. And then you wake up and you realize, I don't want to be anything like my dad. And they're trying to fight and they're trying to be different, and they just fall right in line with what they were doing. Why did they think that they were different? And I don't know if I have good answers here, but this is where we need to start evaluating for our own selves. They didn't think they were as bad as their fathers who murdered all the prophets, and yet they murdered the prophet. So why did they think they were different? What was it that let them slip up in that? Because why do I think that I'm different from my fathers? I know their foolish mistakes, but I know that I'm different. What am I telling myself? Am I speaking the truth or am I lying to myself? We need to evaluate. Stephen told them their history. They knew their history. They didn't need to hear their history. He told them their history in such a way to get them to recognize what they had done and what they were doing. And he was trying to say, you need to listen for the raised up one. And when you find him, listen to the raised up one. And when he tells you something you don't like, that don't matter, you do what the raised up one says. And that was what they were not doing. And we have to come somehow figure out how to evaluate our own lives in that way. That doesn't mean throw off every tradition, but it does mean I need to start thinking about what I'm thinking about. I need to think about what the text says and make sure that I'm reading it correctly. And again, that idea of how did someone keep the law? How do we keep the law today? Well, I think we need to obey the law, and there's all those sorts of things. But I love this idea here. They received the law, but they didn't keep it. They received Jesus, but they did not keep him. And I think that there's a really neat connection there. I'm going to let that be the end of the lesson. There's a lot of sermons that you can, I think that you can preach out of this idea of their heritage of turning away from the raised up one, their heritage of going towards handmade idols, whether it's literal idols or their own possessions and their own self-security, the fact that they were trying to maybe contain God in a box. He's my God and I can give all the rules for him and he's going to be in my handmade temple. I don't know if that's literally what they were doing, but that's what it made me jump at when I was reading Stephen's sermon. But there's a lot there that I think that you can think about and wonder about. And if you need to write a sermon, those are some sermon ideas. I want to close by reading Psalm 95. And we're just going to really drive in the not reassuring theme that apparently Dan Bunting has been writing on today. Psalm 95 is in the collection of psalms in the 90s that are great, and they're uplifting, and they're kingly, and they're encouraging, and 95 really starts that way. And then it stops. It completely stops being that way and slams the lesson right into our faces. And I think that that's a lesson that we all need to read. Psalm 95, and the lesson will be yours. Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great king above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the sheep of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their hearts, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. That's a hard ending. Kind of wish that maybe part A and part B were swapped. But we praise God and everything's great, and God says, don't you dare do what those people did. And that's what we need to think about, that we need to make our hearts right with God, that we worship him in sincerity and truth, not just in physical practice, but in sincerity and truth, and make our lives right with him. I don't know where you are in your journey, what sort of prayers or help that you need, but there's a lot of people here who love you and who want to pray with you and help you out. If there's anyone here who needs prayers or help this evening, why don't you come forward as we stand?